Here's a puzzle. Why does a playwright from Elizabethan England speak more powerfully to American conflicts than any homegrown writer? Shakespeare never set foot in America, yet his words have become the vocabulary through which Americans argue about race, immigration, gender, and power. When Barack Obama confessed that Shakespeare speaks to me in a way that no other writer does, he echoed Ronald Reagan, who quoted the Bard more than any president before him. This isn't coincidence, it's cultural alchemy. When Americans can't discuss their most divisive issues directly, they turn to Shakespeare as neutral ground, a shared language that makes the unspeakable speakable. His plays function like a national Rorschach test, revealing what Americans believe about themselves in any given era. John Quincy Adams fought slavery his entire political life, yet found Shakespeare's Othello revolting, not for its jealousy or murder, but because a black man married a white woman. In 1833, this prominent abolitionist publicly declared Desdemona's love unnatural and her death deserved. At a dinner party, Adams told actress Fanny Kemble that Othello was disgusting. When she published this, Adams spent years defending his position that interracial marriage violated natural law. The irony deepened when Kemble married into a slave-owning family and witnessed plantation horrors, recalling Adams using a slur for Othello while white masters routinely exploited enslaved women. Adams foresaw abolition might lead to civil war, followed by the extirpation of the African race on this continent by the gradually bleaching process of intermixture. Even as his anti-slavery convictions strengthened, he remained fixated on the unnatural marriage, unable to reconcile equality with his opposition to amalgamation. Meanwhile, Othello played regularly in slave states with white actors in bronzed makeup, revealing how Americans engaged with Shakespeare's interracial tragedy while maintaining rigid racial boundaries. Meanwhile, Othello played regularly in slave states with white actors in bronzed makeup, revealing how Americans engaged with Shakespeare's interracial tragedy while maintaining rigid racial boundaries. In summer 1845, future Union General Ulysses S. Grant played Desdemona in the Army's Othello at Corpus Christi, Texas. The 135-pound lieutenant, with girlish features and mild voice, seemed ideal, until his scene partner complained he could not pump up any sentiment with Grant in drag. The Army of Occupation had built an 800-seat theater to combat demoralization before invading Mexico. Manifest Destiny embodied manly superiority. Mexico needed to be taught to respect us like a headstrong wife. When replaced by a professional actress, Grant promptly grew a beard, perhaps countering his feminine reputation. Meanwhile, Charlotte Cushman revolutionized theater, playing Romeo in London, mastering masculine performance while maintaining her ample and majestic bust. By war's end in 1848, America had gained vast territories but lost 100,000 soldiers in what Grant called a wicked war, leading inexorably to civil war. Female Romeos vanished from American stages, marking a shift toward rigid gender performance defining the coming decades. May 10, 1849. New York State Militia fires on protesters outside the Astor Place Opera House, killing over 20 people. Violence erupted when 10,000 to 24,000 gathered to protest British actor William McCready's Macbeth. Newspapers blamed an actor's feud, but the riots channeled America's first reckoning with class warfare fought through Shakespeare. The conflict began when American actor Edwin Forrest publicly hissed during Macready's Edinburgh Hamlet, finding his style effeminate. Macready denounced this as something no Englishman would have done, making it nationalist. Between 1826 and 1848, New York quadrupled to over 500,000, nearly half immigrants. Theaters were democratic spaces where classes mixed, working class in the pit, wealthy in boxes. The elite responded by building the Astor Place Opera House in 1847, introducing numbered seats and formal attire requirements that barred laborers entirely. When protesters hurled cobblestones during McCready's performance, militia fired into the mob. One newspaper noted the riots revealed an opposition of classes, the rich and poor, in a supposedly classless country. Joe Papp later established the public theater nearby to provide free Shakespeare for all, reclaiming democratic ground. John Wilkes Booth died 12 days after assassinating Lincoln, comparing himself to Brutus in his diary. Shakespeare remained central to both men's final thoughts, Lincoln reciting Macbeth passages days before his death, Booth justifying murder through Julius Caesar. Despite limited formal education, Lincoln developed a profound Shakespeare connection, reciting passages for hours and finding solace in the bard's words after his son Willie died. Booth's theatrical heritage came through his father, Junius Brutus Booth, and by his teens, he had developed strong racist views. Booth favored villainous roles, particularly Richard III, which he performed over 100 times. When cornered in a barn, he attempted a dramatic final stand but was shot without warning, dying with the words, "Useless, useless." Days before his assassination, Lincoln read Macbeth aboard the River Queen and had shared a prophetic nightmare about his own death. After his murder, Americans processed their grief through Shakespearean imagery, particularly Macbeth, likening Lincoln to the virtuous Duncan. These parallels helped a divided nation find collective catharsis, proof that when Americans face the unspeakable, they turn to Shakespeare to transform raw historical trauma into comprehensible narrative. Shakespeare, who wrote compassionately about refugees in Sir Thomas More, was weaponized by immigration restrictionists claiming his Anglo-Saxon identity. As 24 million immigrants arrived between 1880 and 1920, Henry Cabot Lodge, armed with Harvard's first doctorate in Anglo-Saxon law, declared immigrants posed economic threats and threatened deterioration. Charles Mills Gailey's 1917 book branded new immigrants as superstitious, grasping, and potentially anarchists. By 1916, Shakespeare's Caliban became immigrant shorthand. Sociologist Edward Ellsworth Ross described the Caliban type as hirsute, low-browed, big-faced persons of obviously low mentality. Percy Mackay's Mask depicted Caliban's transformation from primitive beast to civilized being, climaxing with Caliban prostrating himself at Shakespeare's feet as the Star-Spangled Banner played. A generation later, The Taming of the Shrew processed post-war gender anxiety. Alfred Lunt and Lynn Fontanne's violent 1935 production inspired 1948's Kiss Me, Kate. As women faced pressure to surrender wartime jobs, the musical's controversial spanking scene, unprecedented in Shakespeare productions, mirrored similar scenes in 28 Hollywood films that decade. 4 million Americans saw it during its initial run. The 2017 Trump-like Caesar at the Della Court exposed how partisanship has infected cultural touchstones. When Laura Schaefer discussed the production on conservative radio, right-wing media erupted with inflammatory headlines claiming senators stab Trump to death. An illegally filmed 12-second clip stripped of context went viral. Rather than engaging with Democratic themes, conservative critics focused solely on perceived disrespect. Corporate sponsors withdrew, the NEA distanced itself, and far-right activists disrupted performances, with one woman rushing the stage shouting against the normalization of political violence against the right. Shakespeare's future seems simultaneously secure and precarious. Though more widely read than any American writer and mandated in Common Core standards, the tug of war over his relevance has reached a breaking point. This happened before, in early 17th century England, where playgoers filled the globe seeking understanding of their changing world. Few predicted their divisions would lead to civil war and their rulers' beheading. By 1642, Parliament closed the theaters and demolished the globe. Shakespeare has always been America's mirror, but what happens when a nation can't bear its own reflection? Perhaps the real question isn't whether Shakespeare remains relevant to America, but whether America remains worthy of Shakespeare.